Okay, so for Shear 2. So just a quick 2-minute recap. Last week, I noted that when we're thinking about the halachic system in general, there are three basic factors that every posek balances when he's trying to figure out the theoretical halacha. The first is he analyzes the canonical texts, and then he has to ask the sub-question is, what is considered a canonical text? And we started that discussion last week with the question of, do poskim still treat Chumash or Navi as an active normative text, or do we suffice with what Chazal said in the Gemara? The second factor that they deal with is looking at what previous authorities have said about this halachic issue, which is what we'll address today. And the third issue is they look at custom of poskim, of authorities, custom of the place, of their family, and a whole series of questions. And what we said is that each week we would analyze one question that comes up in each of these three categories. And then we noted that after these three, the posek still has to do two things. He has to assess the realia the halacha is relating to. If you want, if you could just sign up so that I know to send up follow-up from the shir. There's a sign-up sheet over here. Okay. And then he has to deal with the realia that halacha applies to. And then the last thing, and this is what we'll deal with in week four, is he has to factor in any extenuating circumstances, psychological, monetary loss, and the like. And then he comes up with a psak, and that's what we call psak. We said in week five, Rabbi Karavkin will deal with a test case, mitzitza bepeh. Controversial cases are always a great way to see halachic process in action. So what I want to do today is deal with a topic that borders on two of the three factors that I highlighted in Psak. Again, I want to return to the issue of what is a canonical text. And two, I want to figure out why is it that authority, the notion of previous poskim saying X, Y, or Z, or Z, is so important for the purposes of halachic argumentation. And I figured I would kill two birds with one stone in this year. I figured I would analyze the potential reasons why precedent is so serious by looking at the first case, one of the most significant cases of precedent in halacha, which is, why is the Gemara and the Mishnah binding? Or in other words, how did the Gemara and Mishnah go from being just precedent to being a canonical text? And by analyzing the different positions as to answer that question, we'll get an insight into what the potential value is in precedent in that discussion. So we'll kill we'll kill two birds with one stone, answer that very big question of why the Gemara is binding to begin with, and the secondary question is why does authority continue to play such a role in Psak? So let me throw the question out to you. Why do you think that authority is important generally? What limitations or what counter value is there in addition to authority? And you can go back to our first three factors in Psak. And how do you think that relates to the Gemara and the Mishnah? Why do you think that we treat the Gemara and the Mishnah as these canonical texts that cannot be argued on? Right? Why? What do you think? Let's throw the question out. And I know this is a heavy question, but we'll throw it out anyways.
It's based on the oral law.
Right. So one is simply to say that Chazal in the Gemara and the Mishnah are conveying the oral law, and therefore we listen to it because we believe there is an oral law, and this is it. Yes.
Does that mean that we believe that what's in the Gemara is what was also said to Moshe, but not put down in writing?
So that would be the extreme of it, right? That we just say that whatever is in the Gemara is what God said to Moshe, and just like the Torah is binding because God said it, and we can ask why is what God says binding, but we'll just assume that as a starting assumption. That would be the extreme formulation, to say yes, right? The reason that the Gemara is binding is because it conveys the word of God that was given to Moshe but not written down, and therefore it's binding. That would be the extreme, but we will throw a wrench in that in about 1 second. And the problem with that, right, that simple statement, as much truth as there is to it, is what we saw last week. We started the same source last week. If you look at source 1, the Rambam's description of the halachic process. And he writes like this. Right, we saw this last week. Bez din gadol shadarshu ba'achas min hamidos. A court, the Supreme Court, the Supreme Sanhedrin, that derives a law through their understanding of Torah, of Chumash. And another court gets up. And disagrees. How raise this soter? They can contradict it. Vidan kifi mashinire beinav can judge as they feel, as they see fit. Shine emar ela shofet asher yihya bayamim haim. As it says, you go to the judge who is in your days. Eincha chayav lelechet ela achar beitin shevidorecha. You only have to follow the court within your time. Now in the second halach, I'll just say it outside, we noted that this is only with biblical law. Rabbinic law, we have a second level to it, which is once there's a rabbinic law, in order to overturn it, you need a din shegadol mimenu b'chachmal v'minyan, a greater court in number and in wisdom, to overturn it because of a formality in the halachic system, which, if we had time, would have another shiur on it, but we don't have time. But at least on biblical law, the Rambam writes that fundamentally, it is within the rights of every generation's court to reinterpret the biblical law. Which tells you that it's not so simple to say, Shas is the will of God conveyed to Moshe, and therefore we have to listen to it. Because the Rambam tells you that no, every generation has the right to continually interpret it. So, if in fact we stop at Shas and say whatever the Gemara or the Mishnah said is binding, there must be something else going on that makes it that, right, after Chatimat HaTalmud, the sealing of the Gemara, we can no longer argue. Right? And it's easy to say it's simply Moshe said it at Sinai, but as the Rambam says, that's not how halacha worked, at least till Stimat HaTalmud. Right? So why did it work that way afterwards? We have three questions, so I think that was one, two, three. Yeah?
So just, Rabbi Zering, wasn't the reason Rabbi wrote down, started with the Mishnah, was because Nechleshua Dorot, so as the generation that got further away from Sinai, there was a recognition that the oral tradition wasn't working. So at some point, someone had to take a point and say, all right, we're going to start from...
Good. So one possibility is that this is how things should work in theory, but something happened, and we, even though in principle maybe we should be able to argue on the Gemara, we can because we're no longer great enough. Something happened, right? And we'll see that that's going to be one position that's taken. Yeah?
You know, the fact that so many things end in without a resolution in the Gemara. Like we don't have an answer, a lot of teku. You know, like it's not like it's a... Like I hope about the Income Tax Act, there's an answer.
So it's definitely true that the Gemara doesn't answer everything. But the working assumption of post-Gim, usually 90% of time, and in 2 weeks we'll get back to this, is that whatever is clear in the Gemara is binding. Right? If it's not clear, then it's a whole question of... We'll see that that's not totally true either. Everyone thinks that's true, and to most extent it is true, but we'll see that there were very significant post-Gim who thought that that wasn't really the case, even in practical halacha, and we're going to come back to that in 2 weeks when we get to Psikat Halacha V'Shadat Chak, Psak under extenuating circumstances, when suddenly we're going to see very, very ambitious positions that challenge that assertion. But for the most part, the assumption of post-Gim is that if the Gemara is clear, then we follow it. Yeah?
Just wondering, what's the logic, like, as far as to say that based in that is going to argue on, is going to try to understand a something like Raisa, can argue with a later based in, and one can argue with a previous based in, but on the Drabbanan, there, the Gzeira that was enacted by a previous based in, you cannot.
Right. So this is the big question, right? Why is it that the Rambam says clearly this is the case, but why is, and he's just recording Gemaras, why is it the case that at some level biblical law seems to be more flexible than rabbinic law? It's a good question, a very long question. My 30-second answer, which doesn't suffice, and we can talk about it later. I haven't come to a full conclusion on the issue. Is that biblical law? The authority behind biblical law comes from its resting on the biblical text, and therefore, it has to be justified in regards to the biblical text. Therefore, if we assume that the right to interpret is given to each generation's leaders, then their authority is derived from their ability to interpret, and interpretation can change. Rabbinic law isn't interpretive, isn't rabbinic law they institute not from their interpretive capacity, but in their legislative capacity. Right? And in legislation, the authority is derived from the formalities of the system itself, right? Not because it is relating to a outside truth, but simply by the formalities of the system itself. So the fact that we say that you can't overturn something which unless you're a court, which is Gadol Min Chachma Vinyan, is a formality. It doesn't reflect a truth because the rabbinic law to begin with didn't reflect a truth. Right? Meaning biblical law is trying to get to a truth. Therefore, you can argue what the truth is. Rabbinic law isn't claiming to be true. It's claiming to be law. Right? It's not like ultimate truth. It's conventional truth. Right? And conventional truth, you come up with your rules, and the rule we came up with was once a best and have it comes up. It's the same way that an amendment in the Constitution, at least in America, I don't know exactly how it works here, right? An amendment in the Constitution, right, there's the preamble which reflects sort of ultimate values, and then there's the actual laws of the Constitution that reflect each generation's attempt at setting law that it accords with the values of the Constitution, but they don't claim to actually be inherently valuable. And in order to overturn them, right, the way you would overturn it is only with a 2/3 majority in 3/4 of the states, right? Because it's a formality. Once something's in law, you want it to be hard to overturn simply to make law have standing power, right? But it doesn't reflect a truth per se. So it's right. It's ironic in that sense. But that's my answer al regal achas. But it's much more complicated, and especially in the 19th century when the rabbis started to respond to reform, they tried to formulate in a much clearer answer than I just said. I can send you a few articles that, like, not modern articles, like articles written in the 19th century where they were trying to articulate it. But that's my answer in 30 seconds, but we will, it's a good question, but that's my attempt. Okay, so, but what the Rambam makes clear, at least fundamentally with regards to biblical law, it should be true that you are allowed to continue to change the biblical law based on interpretation. And yet we know that doesn't happen in the Gemara. So why is that? Now, before we get to an answer to that question, I want to note just one more thing. And that is that we're going to spend most of this year analyzing why it is that authority, and specifically the authority of the Talmud, is important in law. But as we noted last week, there are at least three factors in Psak. The factor that most comes into conflict with the notion of authority is, as the Rambam just said, analysis of canonical texts, right? And when we talk about precedent, it's not just why is precedent important, it's why is precedent important and how is it balanced against the value of independent analysis of the canonical text. Remember, right, we have three factors, and precedent is not the only factor, it's one of three. So the way it's classically formulated in the Gemara, if you look in 2, for example, is like this. Amarlu Rava l'Rav Papa l'Rav Huna b'Rei of Yeshua. This comes up in several places in Shas. I took one of them. So Rava said to Rav Papa, Ki asi piska de dina didi kamaycha v'chazisu beipircha. When one of my legal decisions comes before you and you see a problem in it, an objection, lo tikra'uhu ad asisu l'kamay. Don't tear it up until you come to me. I isli taima amina l'chu. If I can explain my reasoning, so then I'll tell you. V'ilo. And if I realize I have no way of explaining why I'm right, hadarnabi. So I'll retract. But la'achar misa, once I pass away, lo mikra tikra'u, migmar nami lo tikmaru mine. Don't rule in accordance with me, but don't rip it up either. Lo mikra takre'ne, don't rip it up. Di havai hatam, dilma havamina l'chutayim amig. Don't rip it up, because if I were alive, maybe I could explain my reasoning. But migmar nami lo tikmaru mine. But don't paskin like it, don't rule like it. De'in l'dayin el mashayin avraot. Because a judge only has what his eyes see. And in this conversation, you see that tension. Right? He says, on the one hand, respect my precedent, but don't blindly follow precedent because you have a responsibility to analyze the text independently. And that's the line that Psak tries to walk, is how do you balance independent analysis of canonical texts with precedent? So, this brings us back to our question. Fundamentally, the Rambam says that every Beis Din should be allowed to overturn the interpretation of the Torah, i.e., the ultimate canonical text, of the previous Beis Din. And yet, we don't overturn the psak of the Mishnah or the Gemara. Which tells you that here we have a case of what should be mere precedent turning into canonical text. Or in other words, we have a case of precedent overriding independent analysis of canonical texts, right? Right, we no longer argue on the Gemara, which means their interpretation of the canonical text becomes binding, and we have to listen to it, and that responsibility to listen to their precedent overrides our right to interpret the text independently. In other words, again, we see the transformation from analysis to canonical text, right? What the Gemara says is their independent analysis, it turns into an independent canonical text. What mechanism transforms their analysis into binding law such that we can't argue? And what does this teach us about precedent in general? So we have one possibility, right? Mr. Umberg said, we're not as great as them. Something happened, so we can't argue. Maybe in theory we should be able to, but in order to argue on a previous authority, you need to be as great as them, and we're not. And something happened, and we will come to that. We will see somebody who says that. Other possibilities? Yes?
In the ancient world, and the medieval world, especially from the Rambam's perspective, prophecy is extremely important, and the prophet has God's overflow and could see into things and actually see the form of God.
Right, but no one claims that the Gemara is made of prophets.
But the Chumash.
The Chumash, for sure, but the question is not why Chumash is binding, it's why is the Gemara binding, which is not made of prophets. I understand why prophets are binding, even though the Gemara thinks prophets are not binding, right? Only Moshe is binding, everyone else isn't.
Moses and possibly other prophets from the Chumash have a heavier impact.
So Chazal actually think the opposite. They think Moshe has authority, but everyone else doesn't, right? And the Gemara itself perceives itself as saying that only scholars have the right to rule, and prophets don't, right? So it's actually, I mean, intuitively, I might say you're right, but it's not, right? That's not how Gemara said, right? That's not how the Gemara understands it, right? So why? And the Rambam also agrees with that. The Rambam is very clear. The Rambam says it's a biblical prohibition for a prophet to change law or rule on law.
Very explicitly that prophecy is extremely important.
Correct, but the Rambam says it is prohibited for a prophet to rule. So, yes.
And the basic laws in Judaism have been formed from the Chumash.
From the Chumash, yes. From the Chumash, yes. But we really need to move through it. So we have to just stick to this question. Why is it that the Gemara is binding? Right, Chumash we explained, but why is the Gemara binding? That's the question that I'm interested in right now. Right, we can talk about why the importance of prophecy afterwards, but for our purposes, right, why is Gemara binding?
Because it's based on the Chumash.
Okay, but as the Rambam says, every generation has the right to independently analyze the Chumash. So why is it that we can no longer argue on the Gemara's interpretation of Chumash?
Alan. I think it's because the Chumash itself was interpreted to give the Tanaim and the Amoraim the authority to determine the halakha.
But why them and not future generations?
Well, I don't know the answer.
Right, that's the question, right? That's what we want to answer, yes.
When did it become that way? How long after the completion of the Gemara did we come to the point where we said...
Good question. Good question.
That might have some
yes.
impact.
And that question is very murky, and we don't know the answer, but we're going to see some suggestions.
Roughly?
Sometime after the period of the closing of Gemara, and sometime before the opening of the period of the Gonim. It's the amorphous period we refer to as the Savoraic period, which we don't know what happened in. It's about 200 years of a black hole where we don't know what happened. We have guesses, and we'll see some of the guesses, but we'll see. We only have guesses.
So is it possible that the reason is that at some point, to create uniformity, as let's say there was more dispersion, even it was a practical thing, otherwise we'd get
yes.
different religions.
Yes, and we will see people who said exactly that is purely practical. Yes, so far we have two possibilities, which we will see inside a minute. Yeah, Aaron.
I don't really get how you got from this Gemara that
that after the Gemara, there's no more.
We haven't gotten to that. That's just the assumption. I didn't put that in, right? Meaning, that line I actually didn't put in, right? The Gemara assumes Ravina Ravashi Sofa Ra. I probably should have put that line in. The Gemara says Ravina Ravashi Sofa Ra. They're the end of Psak, whatever that means, right? The way it's understood is that the Bavli is the end of Psak, right? That's how we do it. I didn't put that line in. The second Gemara is just the fact that Halacha balances independent analysis with precedent. Okay, so let's look at some suggestions. Okay, so the first suggestion or series of suggestions are going to be that the answer is there is no good reason why the Bavli is binding. It's binding because we accepted that it was binding. Kesef Mishnah, right? These are big people. Kesef Mishnah, Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of Shulchan Aruch, source 3. V'im Tomar, if the Rambam is right, that every generation has the right to independently analyze Chumash, im kein amaylo pligi amaraya tanoi, then why don't the Amoraim argue on the Mishnah? D'ho b'chol dukta makshin la'amora miyasin zdo mi'braisa. We always see that every time an Amora says something, if it goes against the Mishnah or a Braisa, Tanaitic works, we say, how can you challenge the Braisa? But why should that be a challenge? You're allowed to analyze the Torah anew. Vitzarach lomar anada amri ki haitana vim lo yamar. Vitzarach lomar, and the Amora has to say, anada amri ki haitana, he has to explain himself, I hold like that, Tana. Vim lo yamar ken kashale, and if not, we challenge him. Ukfi divrei rabbeinu rishus nesuna behelohem, lachlok al divrei atanayim. According to the Rambam, it should be true that you're allowed to argue on Tanayim. V'efshar lomar, so it could be, shemiyom chasimos ha-mishnah, from the day of the sealing of the Mishnah, kimu v'kiblu shedarot achronim lo yachloku al rishonim. We accepted from the sealing of the Mishnah that we wouldn't argue on the Tanoim. V'chinasu gam bechatimara gemara. And the same happened when the Gemara was sealed. Shemiyom shenichtema, from the day it was sealed, lo nitan rishut l'shum adam lachlok alea. No one argued afterwards, and the Sefer HaMitzvot of the Sefer HaMitzvot Gadol, the Smag, goes even farther. He says it's not just that we accepted it. He says there was a formal vote in four. He says Rav Ashi ave Rosh Yeshivot Galuyot Yisrael. Rav Ashi was the head of the yeshivot in the diaspora. Mimot Rebbe ad Rav Ashi lo matzinu Torah gdula b'makom echad. And since the days of Rebbe until Rav Ashi, it never happened that there was someone who had Torah and greatness in the same place. And God gave him grace in the eyes of the Persian king, and he sent to all the sages of Israel, and they understood the Mishnah correctly. V'hu'a nikra Talmud Bavli. They set up the Mishnah. They established it. They interpreted it. And that's what we call the Gemara. V'sidru v'haskamat kol chachmei ador. And they agreed to rule like this together. There was a vote. There was an actual vote. They got together and they said, we're going to follow the Mishnah. The same happened with the position. The same happened with the Gemara. And in source 5, to see that this continues, Reb Chaim Halevi Mibrisk, Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, is quoted by Reb Chanan Wasserman in 5. And he says, V'davar zeh sh'alti mimori v'rabi hagrach Levi zatzal Mibrisk. I asked Reb Chaim this question. V'heishiv, and he said, Emet, fundamentally you're right. Gam amora yesh b'kocho lachlok al tana. An amora should be allowed to argue on a tana. V'hadim utminin tiyufta mitanoi lamoroi. So why can you therefore challenge an amora and say, how could you rule differently than a tana? He's allowed to argue on a tana. Who cares? Says, humi shum damora eno cholek al tana. He could have, but he wouldn't. He chose not to. V'ilu yadadiv rei tana lo yacholek alav. If he'd known about the Tana, he wouldn't argue. Abol b'makom shecholek lehedya. Now he takes the logical extreme. But let's say he would explicitly choose to argue. So if it's about agreement, so what if he says, no, I don't agree. So then, go ahead. He's allowed to argue. Efshar liyod alacha kmoto. It could be that we would rule like the Amora against the Tana. And he says something radical. The Amoraim often say about a Mishnah, Zu eino Mishnah, it's not a Mishnah. So at first glance, what most people think that means is there was a mistake. Reb Chaim says, no, that's not what it means. It means he just said, it's not a Mishnah. Meaning it's not halachically binding. It is a Mishnah, but For my purposes, it's not a Mishnah. And we'll see that there's a Rishon who says that too. V'chidush gadol nimsab Ramban. And he says the Ramban himself says something novel. And he says, Dahad mutvinin tiyufta mitana lamora hurak im divrei atana nishnu b'mishnah b'bright. And he says, even that agreement that the Amoraim don't argue on Tanaim is only Tanaitic statements in the Mishnah or the Braisa. Aval mein b'lashon memra, if it's just a Tanaitic statement that's not categorized as a Mishnah or a Braisa, efshar lachlok al divrei Tana, you can argue on the Tana. And then he quotes it. That's what that Rabbeinu Yonah says as well. So Reb Chaim takes the logical extreme of the Kesef Mishnah and says, if it's a bad agreement, so if I don't agree, I don't agree. That's all there is to it. You're right. There's no good reason why we don't argue on the Gemara and the Mishnah, except that we agree that we wouldn't. If you want to skip down, maybe it's worth seeing this now. Skip to 9, right? This position is seems to be the position of the Meiri as well, right? 13th century Provence now, right? We've skipped back and forth here generations. The Meiri in 9 says something, right, extremely radical. So he says that many times throughout the Gemara, we find all types of phrases that make it sound like the Gemara is editing the Mishnah. Right, they're just editing. Oh, this was a mistake. There's a missing word, chisurei machzera. And the standard assumption of poskim is that what that means is the Amora thinks that the Tanaim are binding. It's just that they think there was a textual mistake and they're correcting it. Source 9, he writes, v'im kol zen itma tu alivavot merov atzerot v'hutzurchu achronim l'chaber acharav derech bi'ur v'archava. With all this, the hearts were minimized from all the afflictions, and the later ones, meaning the Amoraim, had to compile an explanation and elucidation. And then he says, Lifamim, sometimes derech stira v'tikun, by destroying and fixing, namely, kishayu achachmei hador maskimim lekach, mimasha ro'im makusha chazaka kimo she'amru, when they would see a mistake in the Mishnah, so they would either say, Matnitin Yichidahi. Sometimes they would say, okay, that Mishnah is a position of one Tana, we don't accept it. Or they would say more radical things like, Samei Mikan, get rid of it. Samei Mikan, remove it from here. Which she understands to mean, get rid of it. Like, it says it, but get rid of it. Eino Mishnah, this is no longer a Mishnah. Chisurei Mechzera, it is lacking, not, I'm fixing the word, it's lacking the correct content. She'ein ha-shleimut, and then this is his conclusion, She'ein ha-shleimut nimtza ba-nivraim af b'muvcharim shebahem. Because perfection is not found even amongst the greatest of men. Ad shelo yiyu achronim rashayin lachlok imahem b'ktzat dvarim. Such that later ones should not be allowed to argue with them even on some things. And the Meiri takes it a step farther than the Kesef Mishnah, the Smag Reb Chaim, and says, Reb Chaim says at least, and the Kesef Mishnah say, we accepted it, or at least 90% of the time we accepted it. The Meiri says, no, it's a fiction. The Gemara never accepted the Mishnah. It sometimes accepted the Mishnah if it wanted to. And if it didn't, it just said, we don't accept the Mishnah. Right? So that which we said that, oh, we accepted the Mishnah, Meiri says, no, we really didn't. It's a really important text, but it's not binding. Right? The Amoraim actively argued on the Tanaim. And that's how he understands all these words in the Gemara. Whether the same thing is true post-Gemara, I don't know what the Meiri would say, but at least the Mishnah, right, the way that we saw in the Kesef Mishnah, he thinks that the same thing that happened from the Gemara to the Mishnah happens post-Gemara to the Gemara. The Meiri denies that. Whether we are doing that with the Gemara, interesting question, but at least on the Mishnah level, the Meiri denies the premise that the Mishnah is in fact binding. A modified version of that is found in 6, right? The Malamed Lahoil here quotes from the Vilna Gaon, and he says, whenever it says there's something missing in the Mishnah, it doesn't mean that there's something missing. It's not that there's something missing. Rak di Rebbe, svir lekechatana de alibi satma velo chaser klal. Alibay, Ugamara Sphere Lake Idochtana, Va Alibay Kamra Hagemara, Chesure Mechzer Vachi Katani, Adkan Lishono. Now, when it says there's something missing, it doesn't mean that there's a textual mistake. It means that Rebbe was wrong when he ruled like that one position, so there's a missing voice of Etana that we rule like. So, it's not quite as extreme, right? He takes the assumption that the Amoraim were bound by the Tanaim, he just thinks they're not bound by the Mishnah. Right? They're bound by the Tannaitic period. They're just not bound by the Mishnah. But so we see like a few cracks in this theory that the Mishnah was the seal. Right? We have those who think that it was just an acceptance. And amongst those, they say, well, it was an acceptance. Maybe it was only acceptance of things that were in the Mishnah or the Gemara, and the Mishnah or the Braisa. Maybe it was an acceptance in general of the Tanaim, but not per se the Mishnah. Or the Meiri, even the Mishnah wasn't really accepted at all. It was important, but it's not binding. And Rav David Tzvi Hoffman just notes here that that's obviously not the case always, right? Sometimes there really were missing words. The Amoraim are also editing, right? But at least sometimes the Gemara is open to the possibility that they're actually correcting Rebbe's psak. So, and in 7 also, you see that the Rif has a version of this acceptance theory that we see in the Kesef Mishnah. He says, "V'anan lo sfir lanachi." He's explaining why we rule like the Bavli against the Yerushalmi, and he writes, "Kevan de sugyan de Gemara dilan le'atira lo ichban lan v'may da'asri v'gemara de b'nei ma'arava." Since our Talmud permits it, I don't care what it says in the Talmud Yerushalmi. "Dal Gemara dilan samchinan." We rely on our Talmud. "De batrau." It's later. "V'inu evi b'kia v'gemara de b'nei ma'arava." And those who authored the Babylonian Talmud were experts in the Yerushalmi. "Tvei minan." More than us. "V'ilav de kimlu lahai membra de b'nei ma'arava lav de samchu lo kashar le'inu." And if they didn't rule like the Yerushalmi, that means they didn't rule like it. And we follow them, right? He just sort of implies that there was an acceptance, right? He doesn't even articulate it. There was sort of a tacit acceptance of the Bavli over the Yerushalmi. How did it happen? I don't know. It just sort of happened, right? So you have this like range of opinions within the acceptance model. Either there was an actual vote, or the Kesef Mishnah there was an acceptance, or the Rif there was a tacit acceptance. But all of them come to the same basic theory, which is that the Gemara and the Mishnah, to the extent that they're accepted, to varying extents, are accepted only because we made them accepted. So now if we take this question from the local question that we're dealing with, why is the Gemara binding, why is the Mishnah binding, to the question is, what is the role of precedent? So one potential answer is that the reason precedent is important is not because it's fundamentally important. It's important because we choose to accept precedent and constrain ourselves by it. Now, this is a question of degree, meaning poskim take the Bavli as much more binding than they do, let's say, Shulchan Aruch. But the point is the same, that one way in which precedent gains its importance is through the acceptance of those who are making decisions. Right? Again, it's a question. There's still going to be a difference in degree. Right? The Bavli is still going to be more binding than Shulchan Aruch. But it does open up that sort of possibility one, that the reason precedent is important is because we choose to accept it. Okay? That's possibility one. And again, there's a range of how important is it, as we've seen, right? Possibility two, the Meiri, right? If I was going to tease out something from the Meiri, let's go to the Meiri for a second, right? The Meiri says that the Gemara didn't actually accept the Mishnah as fully binding. So if that's the case, then why do the Amoraim act as if they do? So I think this opens up possibility two. The reason precedent is important is because part of any legal system, and if you read through legal theorists, like secular jurisprudence, you'll see that they write about this, is that part of a functioning legal system is showing deference to the people before you. And the reason that you will look through a Supreme Court case in any country, and even if at first glance it seems like they're overturning a previous Supreme Court, they'll often say, even they would agree because whatever, even if it's not actually true, maybe they wouldn't agree, is because there's a value in a legal system to showing deference and trying to at least constrain yourself by precedent. Right? What makes a legal system a system with continuity is a certain level of deference, a certain level of feeling constrained by precedent, even if you're not actually constrained, right? In America or Canada, the Supreme Courts are not actually constrained by precedent, and yet they quote precedent, right? They're allowed to overturn it, but they quote it anyways, because that allows for continuity. So I think model two is to say that part of why we're bound by precedent is because, not that we accept it as binding, but that we accept to at least feel its pressure, let's say. Now again, the Bavli, after the Bavli, it may be that the Midrash would agree that we're actually bound by the Bavli. I don't know, right? I assume he does think we're bound by the Bavli. Right, so that's the problem. The Gonim seem not to think that way. So, well, yes, and historically, this comes back to your question, what happened in 200 years after the Stimat HaTalmud? Or when the Stimat HaTalmud even was, is such a murky question that we have no way of knowing.
They didn't even have a manuscript
till... Right, and then people claim, was there a manuscript in the 6th century? Or, yeah, you know, Talia Fishman's book. No, we didn't have one till the 11th century, or whatever it was. Right, so, Inachinami, that's really complicated, and trying to pin it down is going to be hard. And for sure, the Bavli still gets a central status whenever it gets that. Yes.
The precedent's the logic of the law, right? They use the precedent as
correct as the logic of the law, right? It's
right. But it's
yes.
Not precedent in the sense that it's absolute.
Correct. Right. So I think that's what the Meiri, at least in his analysis of what the Mishnah was doing, the Talmud. That's what I would suggest he's showing, that sometimes precedent is binding, not fully binding, but it's important even if not binding. And we'll come back to this in sort of modern Psak. Let's look at two more possibilities, and then we're going to come now to Mr. Rombrook's point in Source 8. Another possibility is no, precedent is binding because we care about truth, and the earlier generations are more likely to have the truth. Now, I would divide that into two. What we'll see in a moment is the Chazon Ish thinks that is absolute when it comes to the Amoraim, right? That they have the truth and we don't in comparison to them. He wouldn't say the same, presumably, between us and Shulchan Aruch. Right, he would say we have to respect Shulchan Aruch because he's more likely to have the truth, but it's not absolutely true the way it is with the Gemara. Right, so again, there'll be different degrees of this, but model three is that the reason we're bound by precedent because they're more likely to have the truth. So look at 8.
But why?
So we'll look at what he says in 8. Right, and you I think you have to come into one of two arguments, either a metaphysical argument which they're closer to Sinai. Right, or a non-metaphysical argument, which is what you quoted, which is there was so much oppression since then that we, by definition, just can't sort of be as good scholars as them, right? We've had thousands of years of galus, which is another formulation that the Gemara itself has. But let's look at the Chazon Ish 8. So he says as follows, Ha'emet bazeh shedor shachar mishnah ra'u et miyud ha'levavot neged balei ha'mishnah. The generation after the Mishnah saw the minimizing of the hearts compared to the authors of the Mishnah. V'adu levetach sha'emet le'olam im harishonim. And they knew that forever the truth would be with the original ones. V'achareishi adu amitara davar shi'efshar shi'asigu heima emet mashalo ziga chad min ha'tanaim. Once they realized that they could never get to the truth the way that the Tanaim did, lo ayu rashayim lachlok. They could no longer argue. V'havei rak shonim kol divrei ha'tanaim shekadmum. They just taught that which the Tanaim taught. V'gami chatimara tamud batlu divrei amora shamar machmar halamada divrei ha'tana. And anything an amora would say that argued on Mishnah, we got rid of. That which the Kesev Mishnah said, that it's only about acceptance, he's not doing justice to the earlier generations. The truth is what obligated them. How can you rule differently than the truth? The truth is no longer with us. Anything that was going to be revealed had been revealed, v'lo yitgale davar chadash, and nothing new would ever be revealed. So, with the Mishnah and the Talmud at least, the Chazon Ish takes the extreme position. The reason precedent is binding is they are right. Now, he wouldn't say that again by precedent later, but the model is helpful for precedents in general to say that maybe precedent is important because they're more likely to be right. Right? Sometimes they're absolutely right, maybe in the case of the Gemara. Sometimes they're just more likely to be right, let's say the Rishonim or Shulchan Aruch. But either way, right, reason three, precedent is important because they represent truth, and truth is what obligates. Possibility four, which no one said, and I'm not surprised because it's quite radical, is to say, I noted at the beginning, right, that one of the things that seemed to have happened is that we moved from treating the Gemara as pure precedent to treating it as a canonical text. And then we tried to explain why that happened. The Dor Revi'i, Rav Moshe Shmuel Glasner, who's 19th century, he's the great, great fourth generation from the Chassam Sofer, hence Dor Revi'i, that's his name, actually just takes it as a tautology. the reason the Gemara is treated as a canonical text as opposed to precedent is because it is a, and the key word and what I just said is, a text. It's a tautology. It is a text, and therefore it is canonical. And listen to what he says. This is very radical. Whoever has due regard for the truth will conclude that the reason this translation was done by Rabbi Yaakov Ellman in tradition of many years ago, and he says, whoever has due regard for the truth will conclude that the reason the proper interpretation of the Torah was transmitted orally and forbidden to be written down was not to make the Torah unchanging and not to tie the hands of the sages of every generation from interpreting Scripture according to the understanding. Only in this way can the eternity of Torah be understood properly, for the changes in the generations and their opinions, situation, and material and moral condition requires changes in their laws, decrees, and improvements. Rather, the truth is that this issues from the wonderful wisdom and profound insight of the Torah, which teaches that the interpretation of Torah must be given over to the sages of each generation in order that the Torah remain a living force with the nation, developing with it, and that indeed is its eternity. Written Torah can be called truth because it is absolutely true. The oral Torah, its interpretation, however, is not called absolute truth, but rather conventional truth, which depends on the judge in your days, meaning it's based on the agreement of the sages. Only that which the sages of the generation agree upon is true in this sense. When they contradict that which accepted as a true until now, their new interpretation becomes the true one for their generation. When the temple is rebuilt speedily in our times, and the children return to their boundary, and the crown is returned to its former condition, and yet the oral Torah will be transmitted orally, and it will be forbidden to write it down, then the sages of each generation will have the right to interpret the Torah according to their own understanding, without reference to the interpretations of their predecessors. For the oral Torah will not have been written down in an iron pen to be unchanging. But from the time of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, and the sages of generations uprooted the prohibition of writing down matters hitherto transmitted orally, it is obvious that it is forbidden to us to dispute what generations before us have set down in writing, in order to remain authoritative for many days. The intent of permitting the writing down of oral tradition was to prevent later generations from disputing the views of their predecessors. Only in this way may we understand the great controversy surrounding the permissibility of writing oral traditions, to the point that the sages of the Talmud said that whoever writes down halachot is as one who burns them. But they held that it is better to uproot part of the Torah than the Torah be forgotten by Israel. And he says, why is the Gemara binding? Because we chose to transform it from oral law or non-binding precedent into canonical texts because we had no choice. But he says something which no one else says explicitly, which is, what follows logically from that is, if it's a temporary measure to protect the Torah, then when that measure is not necessary, when Mashiach comes, the Gemara will not be binding. We will return to the situation in which the Gemara is not binding. Right, which is sort of the extreme of this, which is to say no. Right, the assumption that in some real way the Gemara is now binding law for eternity is incorrect. It's true now, and this adds a fourth possibility, or a sub-possibility. We said that one of the roles of precedent is that it protects us, protects the continuity of the system. He takes that to extreme and says, right, therefore, precedent will lose some of its pull when we don't need it, right? It will move back into the realm of precedent and away from canonical text. So this is a sort of extreme variation of some of the things that we've seen. So again, to summarize, why is the Gemara binding? We have, or the Mishnah binding, we have a range of positions. Those who think it's because it's true, like the Chazon Ish. Those who think we accepted it, and maybe we accepted the Mishnah, and the Brisa, but not other Tanaim, or maybe we accepted, maybe we actually voted on it, maybe there was a tacit acceptance, or maybe it's only accepted temporarily because it's written down and we need to now. Or the Meiri, maybe it really, at least from the Gemara to the Mishnah, it wasn't fully accepted. It was accepted for the purpose of showing deference, but not actually accepted legally. After Stimon HaTalmud, I don't know. I assume he thinks the Gemara is binding, but again, some of the Gaonim didn't really think that, or at least potentially didn't think that. We're not quite sure. We don't know enough about that period. Now, bringing that to our general discussion of the role of precedent, you will see as we go through the rest of the sources, which we'll have to run through a little bit, Poskim, when they discuss why is precedent in general, not the precedent of the Talmud, binding or important, you'll see the same models coming up. There will be those who think that they're binding because they're true, or more likely to be true. There will be those who think it's binding because we accepted it as so. There will be those who think that we have to show deference, but we're not actually bound by it. Right? You'll see all those models coming up in terms of precedent. It'll be much easier after Stimat HaTalmud, because the Talmud, in the end, we accept really as binding. Right? That's l'halacha, how we accept it. How we got there, interesting question, but we do. But we don't accept Shulchan Aruch as fully binding, right? It's our starting point in many discussions, but it's not binding the way the Gemara is, right? So here, post-Gemara, we're going to be much freer to actually say it's binding in a certain sense, but not fully. So just to see it quickly, okay? So 11, now we skip, right? We're skipping, not talking about the Gemara anymore. Question. Let's say a majority of post-Gem say something's usser. Is it now definitively usser, yes or no?
Isn't it decided by majority?
The whole so, let's see, right? Not Gemara, post-Gemara, right? Majority of post-Gemara later on. Yes or no? We got two answers, and both of them will have a shita, so you can be right either way. Who thinks yes? Nobody. See, this is what always happens. After I would give a shir in Gush on methodology, they would always tell me, so you're telling me the answer is complicated. And I would always be like, yes, you got the point of the shir. Good, okay. I said this last week, I think. Rav Lichtenstein said, if I ever ask a question, the answer is, it's not obvious, right? That's always the answer. Okay, so, is majority poskim binding, post-Talmud? 11, Shach brings a machlokes, right? Shabtai Kohen Rappaport brings a machlokes between himself and Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, the Bach. So, the Bach wrote that in cases of Hesed Meruba, of monetary loss, we can rely on a minority position. Shach says you can't. And he says, O Tamal Dorav, I don't understand the Bach. The Bach says, Kaven to be Yachad Neged Rabim, Somchad Mehevsen Meruba. Ava Gavdalacha ki Rabim de Araisa. Even though the majority rules biblically, Shikvar Kasavta, Shikvar Kasva Batorah Achari Rabim Latas, the Torah says follow the majority. So how can the Bach say that under extenuating circumstances we follow the minority? If majority of poskim say something's usher, it is usher, the Torah said so. So what does the Shach think? Right? Once a majority of poskim have said something, is it binding? Yes. Why? Because I don't know if it's actually true, but biblically it's considered to be legal truth, right? So the Shach says, why is precedent binding, or at least majority precedent? Because for our purposes, it is Torah truth. Acharei Rabim Lahatos, the Torah tells you follow the majority. They are now your truth, right?
Just yeah. By majority, you mean majority of poskim in our times, or do you mean majority?
Hold that thought for 1 second. The Bach says no. Right? 1 second. I just want to get through these thoughts and we'll come to questions. I think we're going to have to hold. If it's clarifying questions, we can now, but I think we got to move a little bit. The Bach clearly did not hold that. Right? Why? Right? Why did the Bach think the precedent was not binding? Right? Majority precedent. Acharei Rabim Lahatos is a pasuk, isn't it? Right? Majority precedent is biblically binding. Two possibilities. Either he says no. Right? It's not true. Post, right, Acharei Rabim Lahatos does not mean that precedent is binding biblically. Majority precedent is binding. It's not true. And we'll see why that would be. Possibility two is what you said is, maybe in theory it's true, but you figure out how to count. Right? So practically it's not. And we'll see both positions. Source 12. The Yavetz, Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonam Seifshitz also agrees. Right? They were great at right, they were at each other's necks in their lifetimes, at their throats in their lifetimes, but they agree on this point. And they say, the custom is to follow the majority of poskim nowadays. But I'm not sure why. We should wonder about this. Or you can look at the English, right? We must wonder about this custom of poskim to follow the majority of positions. Because who collected them like a pile of grain? Who counted their number to consider the people? That's my loose translation. Who saw all the books that were written? Who counted them? How can... What did I even write here? How can you... right?
Say eight?
How can you... Oh, God. Okay, I'm going to go back to the Hebrew because my translation here is off. Right? Oh, aye shokel v'sofer. Oh, it's way. That's what it is. It's way. Oh, aye shokel v'sofer leida rov minyan, rov minyan. How do you know? How are you going to weigh who's the greatest? Who's the biggest? Who's the eize yoter machria b'inyan? What majority? Zoe shesha kashel einu. Right? Normally we follow the rove, but it's not binding. And what does he say? He brings a practical problem. He says, look, what rove? Of all poskim ever? Of all poskim who wrote down books? Of all poskim who wrote down books that we have? Of what? Of all rabbis, someone who had smicha? What about, do we take into account how great they are? You figure out, in 1,500 years, since the Stimas HaTalmud, what the majority is. Good luck. So, possibility one is, maybe majority should rule in an absolute sense, but it can't practically. But there's a more fundamental critique, and this is summarized nicely in 13, in the Mishpatim Yisharim. It's a very modern Tshuva Sefer. He just happens to write clearly and be summarizing a whole tradition of Psak. And he says, it seems obvious that it is not called a majority unless they were together at one meeting, face to face. And the sages say, in Hebrew, Nimnu Vigamru, they voted and decided. So he says, no, it's not that there's a practical problem. There's a fundamental problem. When the Torah says majority rules, it means same room, Sanhedrin. Vote, face to face, argue it out, come to the truth, then you can say that you got the truth through majority rules. But what, majority over time? The poskim never saw each other, right? They lived hundreds of years apart. You don't come to the truth by counting numbers over the course of time when people didn't get a chance to hash it out in person. If they hash it out in person, so sure, precedent is binding because you got to the truth. Over thousands of years, that's how you come to truth? No, that's not what the Torah meant when it said rove. So he says, okay, right? So possibility one, he rejects. It's not that we accept poskim, authority, precedent, because it's true. Then why do we accept it? Because as the Yavetz notes, the custom, despite this, is to at least take into account majority. So why do we do that? So you tell me. If it's not possibility one, then what might it be? Because it's not absolutely binding, but it's logical, right? They precedent makes sense. They're right. They were smart. We want to feel constrained by them because it's not absolutely binding, but it points in a certain direction, and therefore it makes sense, even if it's not absolute. And that's what he continues, is, and the custom of arbiters to rule like the majority against a single position of the majority or in books is not because of the law of follow the majority, for often the posik will rule like a single person against the majority. However, when a posik researches to see who the halacha follows, and has no conclusion himself, he says that if many have opined in one direction, and one person the other, it's better to rule like the majority, for it is like following the majority, even if we were not commanded by the Torah to do so. Meaning, it's not because it's true, it's because it points in a direction. We want to be constrained by it. That's the custom of poskim. You see his language, right? We saw this. Precedent is binding because we accept it as so. Because it points in a direction. We show deference. Right? That's what he's saying. It's not possibility one that it's absolutely true. It's some sort of combination of the other factors. It points in a direction. We accepted it. We take them seriously. We show deference. We don't have to, but we do, and it's a good idea. Yeah?
I don't understand how that works, that it's flexible here with that whole, the whole Bakhol story, the Tanur Rishal Achnai. Like, isn't that really going to such an extreme of saying majority, 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 even if God...
But there is a vote, right? There is a vote. That's the thing, right?
But it means that if you could get everyone...
If you could, right.
Then that...
Correct. If you could get the Sanhedrin and Gadol together, then yes. But we can't, so we don't, right? Meaning, but... Poskim, like lining up poskim, is not rove, right? A vote in Sanhedrin is, right? A vote person to person is, but we never had that. So we don't have that, then precedent isn't binding in that sense. It's binding in all the other senses, right? It's important, but not binding. Okay. Yeah.
Why can't we say that there really is there's no argument in that the majority would always rule? However, even the majority would agree that in a case of Hefsed Meruba, you would rule like the minority.
Right, so that's another possibility, right? Which is, but right? The poskim don't in general assume that, right? The poskim in general assume, and we'll come back to this in the fourth week.
The prototype that he's
so,
using
correct.
In the case of Hefs, it's different than a situation where he's ruling.
For sure, for sure. And we'll come back to that in 2 weeks, is how do we justify? Meaning, we're going to see a lot of these sources again when we get to the question of why halacha can change in extenuating circumstances. Right? For now, I'm going to have to bracket it. But in 2 weeks, when we deal with psikat halacha v'sharat chag, that's what we're going to see. Some people are going to say exactly what you just said, right? But right now, we're not assuming that way. Right now, we're assuming that if we're allowed to rely on them in Hefsid Meruba, it's because they might, right, is because they're not binding, right? Not because they would agree. But we'll come back to it. You're right. It could be that there are different rules in Shasat Chag, and maybe that's the key of what's going on. Yeah?
Is there a connection between biblical prophecy and majority rule? What is the connection?
I don't think there is.
Torah.
In terms of practical psak, prophecy doesn't play a relevance because after Moshe, we assume that prophecy is not binding, right? It has no normative value, right? So, meaning maybe it's complicated, right? The role of prophecy, the role of dreams, the role of things like that is a sheer in of itself, but for the most part, it doesn't play into practical psak.
Can I ask you another question?
Yeah.
Is the idea of principle in law because important? Because the Rambam, he organized books of law according to principle, and he was also working on precedent that previous commentators began to organize laws on principle. So when you say that there's a common drift into bodies of scholars and judges, are they moving to this idea that the original halachas and the halachas that are being made and redeveloped are being done with a common thread of meaning, a principle?
Could be. I think, well, let's say this for afterwards. I have to flesh out the question with you afterwards. I'm not fully understanding, but afterwards I'll stick around and you can explain it more. I think I understand what you're saying, but I have to come back to it. Okay, I want to look at one more sugya that really indicates this. So this is one. If you look at source 14, the Gemara in the middle of a discussion of judgments in court says there are certain types of mistake. If a judge makes it, the judgment is overturned. There are other types of mistakes that even though they are considered mistakes, they're not egregious enough to overturn the law. And the Gemara outlines two different categories. The Gemara says, right, what type of error is it? So Amar Leir of Safra L'Rabbi Abba. Ditam Amai, what type of mistake? So Ilema Ditam B'Dvar Mishnah, if you err in a Dvar Mishnah, Amar Rav Sheshes, Amar Rav Yasi, Tav B'Dvar Mishnah Chozer. If you change it in a Dvar Mishnah, whatever this is, and we'll see it in a minute, so then it goes back. So Elav Ditav Shikol Adat, he made a mistake in Shikol Adat, in judgment and not in Dvar Mishnah. We'll come back to these terms. Hechidami Shikol Adat. So what is Shikol Adat? Amar Rav Papa, Kigon Trei Tanoi Tram, Aroi Depligi Ahadadi, Velo Idmar Ilchas, Velo Kimar, Velo Kimar, where there's Tanaim and Amar Rav arguing, but the halacha is not decided like either one. Vesugin Da Alma Liv Dechad Minayu. But the general practice is like one. Vazal Iyu Vavet Kiida Hainu Shikol Adat. So the Gemara sets up two types of mistakes. There's a mistake in Dvar Mishnah, which sounds like a mistake in binding authority or canon, which if you make that type of mistake, the judgment is overturned. And then there's a second one called Shikol Hadat, making a mistake in judgment, right? Which is a mistake in precedent, accepted precedent, right? Which is considered a mistake, but not enough of a mistake to overturn it. So what does that mean, right? What is that split? So, if we look at the next three sources here. So, the Balamor, right, Mizrahi Alevi in Provence, writes as follows. He cites two different positions. He quotes one person who says that I've heard in the name of the sage, of one of the sages of the generations before us, that we no longer have the category of error in Shikol Hadat. For all laws are now authoritatively determined for us, either from the Talmud or for the Gaonim who follow the Talmud. Rather, all who err, err in Dvar Mishnah. So he quotes one person who says, Dvar Mishnah means anything which has been decided. What has been decided?
Everything.
Everything. So what does he say? Why is precedent binding? Because it is binding. Absolutely. It's true. It's done. It's decided. It's authoritative. right? The Gemara, the Gaonim, the Rishonim, I mean, he's in the Rishonim. So the Gaonim, he ends up, but the same argument could go forever. And the Chazon Ish, in one place, suggests this is true up to the Shachan Taz, right? Precedent is, even though that's not actually the Paskins. Anyone knows the Chazon Ish, he doesn't actually Paskin that way. But he says that, at least in one place. So there are some who think that the Dvar Mishnah means, right, binding precedent. Shikol Adat means you make a mistake in non-binding precedent. And he says, everything nowadays is binding precedent, right? The previous generations are always binding. The Baal HaMor himself, turn to the next page, says no. Rather, anyone whose error cannot be clearly demonstrated from the Mishnah or the Talmud explicitly, beyond all doubt, is not erring in the Dvar Mishnah, but in Shikol Adat. And any decision rendered by the Gaonim after the closing of the Talmud as an expression of preference or one view over another, not based upon clear and authoritative law from the Talmud, is like a general position of one who errs and is erred in Shikol Adat. He says no. Gemara, canon, absolute truth, can't argue. Gaonim, you should follow the consensus of the later poskim. If you don't, that's some level of a mistake, but it's not a full mistake, and therefore it's not considered enough of a mistake to overturn the judgment, right? So you have this split. The Gemara, true. Everything later weighs on us, but it's not absolute. Rivet 16. He said, in truth, the sage said that if one errs in one of the decisions of the Gaonim because he did not hear what they said, and he had heard what they said, and he would have retracted clearly and truthfully, that is an error in Dvar Mishnah. He says something totally different. He says, no. What does it mean to make a mistake in Dvar Mishnah? Not that you argue on binding precedent, but that you don't know about precedent. If you know, so what does he say? He says, if you know about precedent, is it binding? No. No. Right? If you know about it and would retract, it's binding. Meaning, if you don't even know what previous authority said, then you are making an illegitimate decision. But if you know what they said and choose to argue, it's legitimate. So what is the role of precedent? You have to at least engage with it. It requires engagement, not acceptance. Right? That's a different model. Right, and now the Ravid says, no, I think that even if he would have argued the Gaon's decision based on a reason that appeared correct to him, unlike the interpretation or opinion of the Gaon, this is also a Dvar Mishnah, for we can argue in the Gaonim. The Ravid himself says, no, that's not true. The position of the Gaonim are not binding because we have to engage with it. They're binding because they're binding. Right? So for we can argue on the Gaonim based on our opinions to explain the issue in a different way to change the law from that of the Gaon without a convincing question, but then he opens a possibility. It's binding unless you know it's wrong. Right? So it's not absolutely binding, it's binding barring an extreme question. Right? So now you have a range. You have the Baal HaMor saying that himself, anything, the Gemara is true, everything after that is important, but not actually binding in that sense. You have the anonymous position quoted by the Ravid, that the role of precedent is that it's something that must be engaged with, but it's not actually binding. And the Ravid saying, no, even post-Talmudic precedent is binding. It is true, or for all purposes, it is conventionally true and must be followed. The Rush, 17. I say certainly, anyone who erred in one of the positions of the Gaonim because he did not hear their words, and when he is told about the ruling of the Gaonim, they are correct in his eyes, it is an error in Dvar Mishnah. This is not only the decisions of the Gaonim, but even the sages of every generation are not cutters in the marsh. And if he ruled against them, and when he heard their words, they seem correct, and he admitted that he was mistaken, he has erred in a Dvar Mishnah and is revoked. But if their words are not correct in his eyes and he brings evidence, so Yiftach in his generation is like Shmuel in his generation, and you only have the judge in your generation, he can contradict him. All things that are not clear in Shas, set by Ravash and Ravina, a person can contradict and build, even to disagree with the words of the Gaonim. When two great scholars argue about a halacha, the judge should not say, I will judge as I please. If he did, that is a false judgment. However, if he is learned and knows how to analyze and knows how to decide, like one of them with a clear proofs, he is allowed to. So what does he say? You must engage. If you don't know what they said, so then you're illegitimate. But post-Talmud, the role of precedent it constrains you. You have to engage with it, but it cannot be fully binding. You're allowed to argue. If he did not know about the dispute of the Gonim and then is told about it, and he is not able to decide or does not know how to rule, if the words of one seem correct and rule like the other, that is an error in Shikla Dat. And when is it considered a mistake? If you hear the non-binding precedent and can't respond successfully. Right? Arguing on the Gemara is Ta'ab B'Dvar Mishnah. Being unable to argue on precedent is Ta'ab B'Shikla Dat. Actively arguing on precedent is what we call legitimate. Right? So, what we have to summarize so far, right, is we saw this both in terms of the Gemara, and then post-Talmud, is we have those who think that precedent is binding, majority precedent, binding, like the Shach. There are those who think that should be true in principle, but it can't because we don't know what the precedent is. So practically, it's only binding because it points in a direction. We've accepted it. It points at truth, but it's not actually true or necessarily true. And then we have positions who say, look, the Gemara is binding, but post-Gemara, we have to engage and we have to be able to respond. But if we can engage and can respond, it's not binding, right? We have to show deference. We have to show that it points towards truth, even if we don't actually accept it. Right? So you see that these themes keep coming up, right? You have those people who treat precedent as true. You have those who say it's only binding insofar as we accept it. You have those who say that precedent is something that we defer to, but is not actually binding. You have those who say it points in a direction, but is not absolutely absolute. And that, I think, right, sort of summarizes the complexity of how we view precedent. And one last point, and this is how we started, is that once we establish that precedent is not, at least in the post-Talmudic period, according to most positions, absolutely binding, what does that bring back? The importance of, what did we say? The other factor? Independent analysis, right? Once you say that precedent is not binding absolutely, that returns the third factor, which is independent analysis, which will now be balanced against whatever weight we set of precedent. And to summarize that, a look at 18. This is a response of Rav Avram ben Aramam. He says, the rule, right? How does he summarize it? A judge who only decides by following that which is written and explicit is weak and soft. And this will nullify what they said. A judge only has what his eyes see. However, it should not be this way. Rather, the things that are written are the basis, and the one judging a case or making a halachic decision should weigh them in every matter that comes before him to compare the case to those that are similar and to extrapolate from those principles. The precedents, which include some of the laws, were not recorded in the Talmud for naught, for were also not for the judge to rule based on them. Rather, they make the sage, who has heard them many times, to use his discretion and make correct decisions. Right? And once we moved away from saying that our precedent is absolutely binding, we're left where we started with, right? That there are multiple factors, and the goal of a posek, and you've seen a range of exactly how this is done, is to balance independent analysis, his independent understanding of the sugya, with precedent. That's true both from in the Mishnaic period, the Talmudic period, right, and all the way through Poskim. And you'll see that Poskim will draw lines at different points. What they think goes into the level of canon, things that are true, and what goes into the level of precedent that must be reckoned with. They'll argue drastically where to draw the line, but the same methodological point, that psak is a balance between those two factors, remains true throughout, I think, halachic discussions, and that is just the second important point I would make in terms of halachic